We can read the news and follow current events, many times only to become more discouraged. The honest truth is that this world is not a place of rest, and is not a place where we are going to find lasting joy. There is truth in understanding that there is much turmoil that surrounds us. But how can we as Christians smile? What gives us comfort not only in the life to come, but even today? How are we to live in such a trying world? These are questions that we consider in our series titled, Sojourning Under the Sun. Well, this passage here in Exodus 15 is a passage that's quite remarkable, considering who the people of Israel are, and just don't read ahead to the end of chapter 15, because you will certainly marvel as to why God redeems such a people. But just looking at this chapter and up to this point and what the Lord has done, think about the history of what we've covered. As a mighty nation, we said probably maybe 2 million some people roughly, walking through the sea, pinned between Pharaoh's army and the sea. This group of people comes from a barren couple who did not think that the Lord was able to carry out his promise. And the Lord did. And the son Isaac, who means laughter, commemorating their cynical response to his promise. And his name becomes then from a cynical response to a laughter of joy, a laughter of comfort, a laughter of celebration. There's that same son who has two children, the one that the Lord loves and the other the Lord does not love, as he is revealed from their birth. But he doesn't want the Lord to choose accordingly, and so he tries to manipulate the hand of God to choose Esau, but that doesn't happen. We find that Jacob is the one who receives the Lord's promise. We find Jacob having 12 sons through 4 women. And we find that even in the midst of this family, there's sibling rivalry, and they sell their brother into slavery to a descendant of Ishmael, a son who is sent away from Abraham, who does not love the Lord and actually mock the promises of God. And we find now, here is this family, that Joseph, who was sent over to Egypt, sold to the Ishmaelites, or basically the descendants of Ishmael, sold over into Egypt. We find that it's because of him the people are brought over into Egypt, become a great people, a great nation. Pharaoh forgets about this Joseph, and here they are. And I think it's something to remember in the point of this is that this great nation that the Lord has called, we can so easily celebrate the glory days of Israel, but the reality is it testifies to the Lord's long suffering, not only in carrying out his redemptive promises, but even putting up with his own people and what they have done and how these promises have come to be. And so now when we look at Exodus 15 and we look at the context, and it's a reminder, I do want to recall to us that it's not the people who did this. The people did not bring this about. The people did not rise up in some sort of a coup or some sort of rebellion against Pharaoh that was organized. It's the Lord who made this absurd promise, basically saying to Moses, look, I'm going to set this up so you simply walk out of Egypt, knock on doors, people give you gifts, and you leave their land. I mean, it's a rather laughable thing. But yet, that's exactly what the Lord did. And the Lord doesn't laugh about this. This isn't something comical. The Lord is just revealing to Moses, this is what I'm going to do. And so here we are in this celebratory song in Exodus 15. And so when we look at this song, can the Lord really bring such a people to understand and celebrate his blessings? And is this something that we can celebrate even today, and how? And so we'll see simply just 2 stanzas that are going on here. First, we have the Lord wins, and secondly, the kings lose. And basically, it's divided in verses 1 through 12. You have the Lord's wins, and you have verses 13 through 18. We have the kings lose. And so remember here with the Lord wins, where the people of Israel are, where we left off. We left off with the Egyptians crying out the Passover promise and the Passover event and what Israel was to do. Pharaoh sends Israel out in the dark of night. The Lord shepherds them. And he shepherds his people in a rather significant way as well, because he guides them through the night with basically a pillar of fire. And he puts a cloud behind his people. And so what he's doing then is he's basically shining a light, giving light to his people in the darkness, quite literally, as John's gospel plays on this very theme. But that's what the Lord's doing. He's lighting the way so they can travel safely through the wilderness, and at the same time providing protection so that if any enemy would try and sneak up upon the people of Israel, they're protected. And the Lord also, in his shepherding care of his people, does not lead them through the Philistines because he knows what? Exodus 13:17-12 tells us. Because he knows his people might be frightened if they have to engage in war at this time. Now, notice it's not the Lord afraid of engaging this nation or the Lord afraid of engaging these people. The Lord knows what he can do. But he knows that his people are not ready to go to war at this point, and so he does not want to put them in this predicament, in this situation. So he leads them around. We find in Exodus 13:19, they also leave with the bones of Joseph, that the very confidence Joseph had that the people of Israel would leave Egypt, they would go to Canaan, is once again finding its fruition. Well, once again, the Lord hardens the heart of Pharaoh in Exodus 14:4. And remember, with the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, it's not that the Lord is doing something to Pharaoh where it's entrapment, where you can say, well, how could the Lord do this to this poor man? No, it's simply the Lord letting Pharaoh be Pharaoh. It's the Lord just letting Pharaoh basically obsess about what he's losing, and he's losing the people of Israel. And what happens then? Pharaoh sends his army out to pursue the people of Israel. Now, I do think it's rather comical, and I'm not saying I'm any better than the Israelites, but at least looking at it from my context and our context as well. Then when you think about what happened with Israel, think about how they plundered the Egyptians. When you talk about plundering, you're basically going from house to house, and in this plundering, usually you have a sword or weaponry, and may have a guard standing by, making sure that if anyone's trying to rise up or get in their last licks against the army, that you're protected. But the plundering that Israel does is quite marvelous. It simply would be along the lines of us going across the street and asking for a cup of sugar. And the person across the street saying, here, take all my gold, take my car, take my lawnmower. In fact, just walk through my house, whatever you want, just take it, get out of here, don't ever come back, I don't want to see you again. So there's no threat. There's nothing that comes against you. That's the type of plundering Israel has done. And you would think that with Israel plundering the Egyptians in this way, they would say, I can't believe what our God has done. I mean, look at how our God has defeated the enemies in such a way that we are not just simply walking out of Egypt, but we're walking out of Egypt with everything we need, essentially the wages and compensation for these years of slavery, and it's just been handed to us. But as the Egyptians rise up, how do the people of Israel respond? And the people of Israel are terrified. Because as the Egyptians rise up and as the Egyptians come against them, the people of Israel basically ask Moses and ask the Lord, why did you bring us out? Here we are trapped, you know, by Exodus 14:10. We're trapped. What did you do? Bring us out here just to die? What's the point of this? We should just go back to Egypt. You can understand why the Lord doesn't want them to engage in war. You can understand why the Lord understands his people. And at the same time, we can look at the Israelites and say, how can this be? The Lord brings you out, you plunder them in such an easy way, and now you turn and say, wow, you know, this is too big of a problem for God to solve. He just released you from one of the mighty empires of the day, and you walked out of there with everything you need. You don't think the Lord can figure out how to basically overpower the Egyptians and figure out how to get you through the sea? But it does remind us, doesn't it? Because we're no different. We can look at the Israelites and say, how could they? But the reality is, how can we? Because we too, in the same way, can look at insurmountable problems and say, how can God overcome this? How can God do something? Is he really a God of deliverance? Christ tells me not to worry, but does Christ really know what it means not to worry? Well, the Israelites, as they're panicking, wondering what's going to happen, the Lord has an absurd solution. And he tells Moses to simply raise the staff. The Lord's going to part the sea. and you're going to walk through the sea. I mean, really, think about how absurd that sounds if you're Moses. I just raise my staff, the sea parts. I mean, we're familiar with the story. So for us, we say it's marvelous God's done this. And it is marvelous God has done this. And I believe it really happened in history. I don't think that Moses is making something up. This really happened. God really delivered his people in this way. But to simply lift your staff against this mighty army and the sea is going to part. But sure enough, Moses lifts the staff. The seas part. And the Israelites pass between basically the two walls of the sea, walking on dry land, and they're unscathed. When he gets to the other side, Moses lowers his staff, the sea folds in around the Egyptians, and they are swallowed in the sea. This mighty army, this great people, who are going to rise up against the Lord and show the Lord that this God is not one who is as strong as he claims to be. Pharaoh in his arrogance saying, I don't know this God. Well, he's come to know him with great loss and in great misery. This is why Israel celebrates and joins together in this song. And the song then is to commemorate a great reversal that's taking place. Because quite literally, moments before Pharaoh encountered Moses interacting with him, however long or however much time has transpired, doesn't seem like it's been that long, it certainly hasn't been 400 years, but as Pharaoh is interacting with Moses and Moses is showing more and more the hand of this God, more and more we see how helpless God's people are. And how tyrannical this man is as he's willing to do some horrible things to make these people afraid of him and terrified of him. A man who very much thinks he's on top of the world and a God himself is quite humbled. Because the song is that reversal of the Egyptians being on top of the world. Now, ironically, this great military power, this world empire is now in the belly of the earth, quite literally, in the thoughts of the minds of these people. That they move from on top of the world to basically the depths of Sheol, to death, to nothingness, being swallowed by the sea. While the Israelites, who are those who are humbled, a people who really had nothing to offer, are those who are now on the other side of the sea, on top of the world, celebrating the reality of who they are, having plundered their enemies. And so this celebration then, as Moses and the people join together, who's the one who triumphs? Well, they're going to sing to the Lord. Because why? This is a God who has triumphed gloriously. What has he done? He has thrown the horse and a rider into the sea. And this, too, is something that becomes rather comical, because if you heard the strategy that the Lord had, it's rather funny. I mean, the Lord's basically saying, I'm going to open up the sea. You're going to pass through this safely. The Egyptians are just going to get swallowed in the sea. And you sort of scratch your head and say, well, how do you know this is going to work? I mean, this sounds like there's a lot of conditions here. But it goes exactly as the Lord has said. Again, God does not stutter in carrying out these promises, no matter how absurd they may sound to us. God is able to do these things. Because who is the Lord? He is the one who has become the strength, my salvation, as we find in verse 2. And notice who this Lord is. My Father's God, I will exalt him. So as I began in the sermon, and you think about this starting with Abraham as the one who's called out, promised to be the father of a multitude when he's a barren. When he's barren, he has no children, and yet he's going to have many children. We find that this is being or coming to fruition. God is showing that he is the God of their fathers, a God who carries out these redemptive promises. But when he says he's a God of my salvation, he's a God of my deliverance, he's a God who is serious about his redemptive promises and carries us out. Now notice then sort of this comical statement in verse 3 that echoes what Pharaoh has said. I do not know this God. Who is this God? I do not know him. Well, now verse 3 tells us who he is. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. In other words, when Moses says, who are you? He says, I am, or I'm Yahweh. Moses or Pharaoh says, who is this God? He says, well, it's Yahweh. It's I am. I do not know this God. Moses is saying, this is who this God is. He's a God that when he says, I am going to bring my people out of the land of Egypt and I will triumph. I am the God that if you do not let my firstborn son go, I will kill your firstborn son. In other words, this is not a God who bluffs. This is not a God who makes false promises. And verse 3 is celebrating that. That in accomplishing his salvation, this is not a God we want to trifle with. But if you're on his side, as Psalm 2 and our call to worship calls to our attention, blessed are all who take refuge in him. But those who do not take refuge in him ought to be terrified. Because this is not a God you want to encounter and you want to question and you want to challenge. You will not prevail. Plain and simple. That's the point of what Moses is making in this song. But as he's a man of war, he's a God who sets out to accomplish what he has done. There is no superpower. There is no might who is going to overpower him. As the Lord has done the impossible, if you will. How can one take out a whole army in just one move? Well, the Lord showed us how. You lure them into the sea that you've just divided without any trickery. You just open the sea up and you know they're foolish enough to go in and you swallow them up. The Lord is triumphant. But notice as we find in verses 4 through 10, we find this power that's called to our attention. And just running through a few of these things. The chariots and the officers of Egypt. Now, the chariots and the war horses, if you search in this in Scripture, this is something that the Lord warns Israel and says, when you go into the land, do not be scared of their horses, do not be scared of their chariots, because I am going before you. You see, this chariot would basically be, in our day and age, saying like they're tanks, they're warplanes, they're battleships. That's what a chariot would be. So these men who are skilled in using their chariots and getting around the battlefield and slaughtering many men as skilled soldiers, the Lord has simply taken out without any casualties. No casualties of war, no casualties for his people. He has basically executed this death blow exactly as he has intended without having any consequences upon his own people. So he's protected his people and taken out the mighty warriors of Egypt. It tells us they've sunk like stones or like bronze or metal, however you want to put it. The intention's the same. In other words, in all their greatness and in all their might and who they claim to be, well, they didn't last very long. They couldn't swim to the surface. They couldn't rise up against this God, even though they were bold enough to rush after his people. They weren't going to do this. The Lord does this with his right hand. It's important. It's not Moses raising a staff. It's not the Israelites joining together. It's the Lord with his right hand. Again, when you think about the right hand used in Scripture, Benjamin, son of my right hand, it's a place of power, a place of strength. So the Lord using his right hand is the Lord using his strength and his power. The Lord's greatness and majesty is made known. The Lord blew out, basically, the languages through his nostrils, that basically he just exhales. This isn't the Lord working up a sweat. This isn't the Lord figuring out how to, coordinate a bunch of things that happen at once. It's simply the Lord letting out his breath. That's the intention. It would be just us exhaling, blowing, and all of a sudden the sea parts long enough for, roughly 2 million people to walk through the sea, enough time for Pharaoh's army to go into the sea before it closes in around them. And we notice that as the people celebrate, let us plunder, let us take from them, the Lord doesn't allow them to plunder. The reality is these mighty men who claim all their greatness will not triumph over the Lord. So when the Lord tells Israel then, don't worry about the chariots, don't worry about the war horses, like for instance in Joshua 11:6, the reality is the Lord set a precedent. These things are nothing to me. They don't scare me, so don't be scared of them. They cannot rise against me. The Egyptians wanting to celebrate dividing the spoil amongst themselves. I mean, do you understand how tyrannical that is? Where did Israel get the spoil? This isn't their wealth. The spoil is from the Egyptians. So what these soldiers are basically doing as they're storming into the sea is they're basically chanting, we're going to steal your spoil and divide it amongst ourselves. They're stealing from their own countrymen. There's no intention of bringing the spoil back. The intention is a soldier's bravado of claiming trophies of war from the Israelites that come from their own countrymen. And so you're seeing how this nation even functions, that they desire to seize the things from their own people. But I think the other thing we need to take from this is an important thing, especially when we go on in the song about the Lord having his people dwell in his abode. This language of the Spirit and the waters. These are echoes to Genesis 1:1 of the Spirit of the Lord hovering over the waters. And the intention here then is that with the Lord breathing out, it's again the Lord dividing the waters, allowing his people to walk through a baptismal event where they're walking through the sea, as Paul calls us, a baptism in the sea. And they emerge safely on the other side. The Lord basically taking these waters where there's a separation between water and land and now closing it up. And so what is the Lord doing? He's basically taking his people through this old creation of curse, uncreating it, and then recreating it so they emerge on the other side as those who have been vindicated through this basically this valley of death, this water of ordeal or this water of trial, whatever you want to say. And they emerge victorious in a new creation. It's the same thing you see with Noah in the flood, the same sort of echoes that are going on of the Lord drying up the earth, Noah emerging out of the ark as a new humanity. It's the Lord showing his people that in order for them to have life, it's not about them engaging in war with the Egyptians. It's about them emerging on the other side of this baptismal event in the new creation as his people dwelling in the midst of their God. Because what does it go on to say after he talks about this water and this ordeal? He asks this question, verse 11, who is like you? Who is like you, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like you, majestic in holiness, awesome in glorious deeds, doing wonders? In other words, this is a praise of what God has accomplished, not only in redemption, but what God has also accomplished in his creation and has accomplished in his new creation in bringing these things about. Pharaoh himself claims some sort of a godness to himself. But this is the intention. This is the taunt. Who is like you? Here are those who claim to be gods, but who are they? Where's their armies? It goes on to talk about where that army is. You stretched out your hand against this other god and against his minions of war, and where are they? The earth swallowed them up, basically at the Lord's command, celebrating who God is as a creator king, this creator architect who designs this creation, orders this creation, calls it into being, takes from nothing and orders it into something. And we find now this mighty man who claimed godlikeness to himself is in the belly and heart of the earth in the realm of the dead, and his army and everything he's claimed to be is ultimately nothing. So truly then, the first part of this poem or this song is a celebration of God and who he is, that he is a God of victory. But where do we see then the kings ultimately lose and we win in all this in verses 13 through 18? When we find why there are those who lose in war. Because in order for his people to enjoy this new creation, how are they led? Now we could say literally they're led through the fire and the pillar of fire going through the wilderness of the Lord's presence being with them as a shepherd walking before them with a dark cloud behind them providing protection, with the angel going as a defender and the one who also takes up the rear seeing to it that no one rises against him. Now that's certainly true. But Moses wants to take this in a whole other direction, not just to one singular event. This one singular event is fruit of something else. He tells us in verse 13, you have led in your steadfast love. And I think that's an important thing. It's not because we're worthy. Israel cannot claim they're here because they're worthy. I mean, you find already in Exodus 14, they're terrified. You bring us out here to die? Why'd you do this? And again, I'm not saying I'm any better, and if I was in this situation, that I'd be any stronger. But the reality is, it shows us how weak we are as humans. And yet the Lord is faithful to His covenantal promises. He leads in His steadfast love. But notice also who we are. It's not just that He leads in His steadfast love, but He has redeemed. Now this redemption, it's not, I mean, in our day and age, we take it as something positive, but it's not necessarily something positive. It's something that testifies to someone's failure. If we need to be redeemed, it means we have failed. We have put ourselves in a situation where we are sold into slavery and someone needs to buy us out of slavery. It's not a celebration of success. It's a celebration of someone being merciful to us and thus saying, thank you for buying me out of slavery. And it's Moses saying, God has redeemed. God has paid the price. And where is He leading His people to His holy abode? Now, there are some people that obviously wrestle with what does this mean? They're not in Canaan. They're not at Mount Zion. They're not in Jerusalem. And so there's obviously a whole variety of ways of resolving this. I think the simple way to resolve this is taking verse 13 and what verse 13 means. It's a call for us to join with the people of Israel in knowing who the Lord is, the God who leads His people in His steadfast love and mercy, the God who is leading His people to dwell with Him, and this is by the Lord's leading. What is the ultimate abode? Well, it's the picture you see here of God's people standing on the shore, celebrating the Lord's victory, celebrating the Lord's redemption and His accomplishments, dwelling in the presence of God and saying, praise you, while all their enemies have been put down. They look out, they can see the evidence of things washing up on the shore, testifying to the reality of this event really did happen. This isn't just a dream, that the next morning is just as true as the night before, that the Lord really has done this. And so this abode then, it really is what we're getting at in the title, this Sabbath celebration of knowing where the people are ultimately going, where God's people are going, dwelling in the presence of our God, dwelling in His presence where He has brought us. Now notice the result of this. That now you have these different peoples. Well, Philistia. You have basically the Philistines that Israel encounters. Edom, descendants of Esau. You have Moab, again, tied to the Moabites, descendants of Esau. You have the inhabitants of Canaan, the place where Israel is to go in and make war. So basically, these people have historically made war with God's people and have joined with Pharaoh historically in saying, well, who is this God? I don't know this God. Is this God able to redeem? That Moses is saying they've taken note of this and they're trembling. They're noticing that this is not a God that one trifles with. You don't challenge this God and expect to walk away okay. When the Lord says, this is what I'm going to do, it means this is exactly what the Lord is going to do. It may not be in our timing tomorrow or in an hour from now, but the Lord will accomplish this and bring it about. He has told Abraham, your people will be enslaved for 400 some years. I will bring them out by a mighty arm. Here we see the very evidence of this reality. And now the people are taking note. The nations, the empires that have historically been arrogant against this God are saying, maybe we ought to think about who this God is and be a little cautious as we interact with His people. Because the reality of who this God is, with His terror and His dread falling upon them, it's a terror and dread of knowing that this people that were in captivity and slavery for 400 years now stand on the top of the world. Those who enslave them and abuse them are quite literally in the belly of the earth. And so the reality of where the people are going then, this goes on. So you have verse 13, you talk about where the Lord is bringing them to their holy abode. Now in verses 17 and 18, we have once again this doxology, this blessing, this praise. Because who is the Lord? You will bring them, you will plant them on your holy mountain. The place, O Lord, which you have made for your abode, the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. So again, you have this new creation type language of the Lord using his hands to build this sanctuary, the Lord using his hands to build this mountain like he did in the first Eden, in the first creation of what he promised he would do for Adam and Eve. Moses is praising him and saying, Lord, this is where we're going. We're going to your holy mountain. Now, the holy mountain, the place of rest, is a place, the mountain of Zion. The place, the city of Jerusalem, place on top of this mountain. It's the place where we have rest and we dwell in the presence of God in his temple. And how do we know that the Lord building this is so assuring? Because the Lord will reign, what, for a generation, from our fathers, for a couple of years, for a few decades, and then he has to renew his contract? No. Moses tells us why this is a song we can take upon our own lips and we can join together with the people of Israel. Because the Lord will reign forever and ever. In other words, there is no end to his reign. We talk about who Christ is and these different Christological controversies. The basic issue is simply this. If Christ didn't take on real flesh, then we're not really redeemed. If Christ really wasn't raised in glorified flesh as a God-man, then we're not really redeemed, and God is not ruling and reigning forever and ever. But the reality is God is reigning forever and ever. And so the celebration of Israel is very much this picture, this precedent of what happens when Christ comes again. The very impossible thing that we think is impossible. We look at the nations, we look at the things going on around us, and we say, how can this possibly end well? How can we possibly be delivered through this? It's the assurance of knowing the Lord will reign forever and ever. And when Christ comes again, it's the assurance of knowing that we too will be the people separated unto the Lord as we find our refuge and our hope in him. And we will celebrate who he is, and we will be taken to the true holy mountain, to the true Mount Zion, to heaven itself, to dwell with our God and to dwell and bask in his glory forever and ever, praising him for his redemption. And again, as Israel needed to be redeemed, so we need such redemption. For we too are a people who have gotten ourselves into a pretty bad predicament in Adam. That we are those who deserve death, we deserve hell, we deserve all sorts of punishment to come our way. But by God's grace and mercy and the sending of his Son, that's not ours. Christ took it in our place so we can have life. This then is that very Sabbath setting, that celebration, that praising of the Lord, where we dwell in his presence and we finally see his redemptive promises that he has asserted. That we, maybe in our cynical moments and our times of doubt, may say, the Lord can't really do this. As Israel themselves in Exodus 14:10 doubt the reality that God can really deliver them. We turn the page, we find Exodus 15 with them all celebrating and joining together in praise because the Lord really has delivered them. And so when we ask that question then at the beginning and in conclusion, can the Lord really bring such a people who have had such a checkered past, if you will, to celebrate him and his blessings? Well, the answer to that, as we see, I hope we see, yes. The people of Israel joined together, marveling at the hand of God. And how is this then a Sabbath celebration? Well, it's showing us that the Lord's people really will enjoy the blessing and provision of our God. It's the comfort of knowing that God will triumph because he has triumphed in Christ. And the reality is, we may say that that's only true because Christ has been raised from the dead. Well, certainly. That's the precedent that grounds the reality of his redemptive promises and his cross-shaped logic. Paul says that. But this event isn't just true because Christ has been raised from the dead. This event is true is because Christ, because God has said what to Moses? I will deliver my people. He said this to Abraham. Your people will be enslaved. I will bring them out by a mighty hand. It's true because God once again has done this event. It has meaning because God is with his people here through the Red Sea. He's with his people today as we walk in his spirit. And it's a guarantee that when Christ leaves and he tells his disciples at the Last Supper in John 14, a wonderful speech that Christ gives as John allows us into that discussion in the Last Supper. What is he saying? I need to go. I need to go to heaven. If I don't go to heaven, you can't arrive there. But I'm not going to leave you alone. I will send the helper. I will get you there. And I will come and I will bring you back. And so people of Christ, when we hear Christ saying, I will bring you back, how we too can fall into the doubts of Israel for 400 some years, saying, when is God ever going to bring us out of this land of slavery? Is God really capable of doing this? Then basically with the snap of a finger, they plunder their neighbors, with their neighbors simply giving them anything they want without any challenge and sending them away. They walk through the sea triumphant, and they walk into this new creation. How assured ought we to be that when our Lord says, I will not leave you as orphans, I will return, you too will enter my Sabbath rest. How assured ought we to be that because of Christ, we too will enter his Sabbath rest. Let us long for that day. Amen.
Thank you for listening to our broadcast. We hope and pray that you were edified through the preaching of the gospel. If you have any questions about our church, please contact our pastor through our webpage, urcbelgrade. That is urcbelgrade.com. We hope to hear from you, and most of all, we hope to see you sojourning and fellowshipping with us each Sunday. Until we meet again, may the Lord's blessing and peace be upon you.